from Tupelo, Mississippi.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Malik. I'm an alcoholic. I live in Tupelo, Mississippi. I think maybe it's because God has a sense of humor. Or maybe as the story unfolds, you may figure something else out in it. It's a privilege to be with you. It's a gift. It's a blessing in my life to be given the opportunity to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous today, because for years before I came to you, and even for years after I came to you, I still believed that I was different. And I like to think today, and I remind myself, that alcoholism, for me at least, is the disease of being different, and it's deadly for me. When Annette said that I wasn't well, that could mean many things. It's probably because I have a real interesting dose of the pink eye that I've been trying to shake for about 8 days, and all that good stuff. Dublin, Ireland is my hometown. Born and reared. I notice people say we were raised. You raise cattle. People are reared. The second of four, I came to the United States because I'm often asked that in 1971. Came to the city of New Orleans. And I'm frequently asked, how come you've never lost your accent? And I say very simply, I saw no reason to. There's alcoholism in our home growing up. For years I used that as an excuse. Gave me a lot of mileage. Blame others. Today I'm able to say to you, because of the gift of these principles in Alcoholics Anonymous, that my mother and father gave me a very special gift, which is the gift of life. And I was part of their life in the way that they chose, and also a lot of it had to do with me. Because I frequently hear at meetings that some of us believe that we don't fit, we don't connect, we don't seem to be a part of, and that was me. I always seemed like I wanted to be somebody else. And could be like you, I'd be okay. And that was me. I do know, looking back, that part of my life was definitely that I learned at an early age, and that was about me, not about anybody else, but I learned not to feel and not to trust. And it was like I would not allow anybody in, because I thought if I let you in, you might hurt me. And I always kept you distanced. And it just seemed that was me, my thing. I was not able to connect with other people. I just wasn't. The times I felt safe were interesting, and they were connected with alcohol. Isn't that strange? When we were little kids growing up, when we had diarrhea or the runs or the trots, as we used to call them in those days, my mother's solution for the trots was to give us a glass of hot milk with some grated nutmeg and a shot of Irish whiskey or brandy in it. And what that was supposed to do was to bind up our stomachs. You see, and what I remember was that warm feeling coursing through me, and I felt safe, and I felt wonderful, and I felt happy, and I tried to have the trots as often as I could. And I know it says in our text that we alcoholics drink for the effect. And I know I listened very carefully to Tom last night, and I'm grateful to Tom, not to put him on the spot, but I need heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not about longevity, but to me it's about God working in people. And I need these heroes, and I have many heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I can look at you in a different way today. Before, years ago, I wanted to be like somebody else, because to run away from me. But today, you see, I can sit and I can stand with you. And I can look up to you for one reason, because my God is good, and my God is in and with you, and so my God is with me. And one of the gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me today is, before I came to you, I'd studied a lot about my God in the scriptures and theology and all that other stuff I used to be involved with, and I knew a lot about my God, but when I came to you, I met him. And that's for me today that makes the difference. That when I'm with you, I feel safe. because I feel like I am in the presence of my God. That is that presence. It wasn't always that way. I was also an altar server because I was raised in the Roman Catholic tradition, like many young Irish men and women are. And after those masses and services, when there was some wine left over in the cruets, I thought it couldn't go to waste. And so what I would do is I'd grab it and take a little slug when nobody was looking, I thought. And again, I remember the feeling. That's what I was looking for. And listening to Tom last night, he talked about his journey and how he became alcoholic. And I can respect that. And I don't know of me. I know what I am today by God's grace with you and from you. But I do believe that even back in those days, if I'm describing that the alcoholic is a person who drinks for the effect, I think I was alcoholic in my behavior in those days. Because I would look for booze because of what it did for me. It changed how I felt. It made me feel a part of, and it made me feel warm, and it made me feel safe. So here I had the troughs on one side of me, and I had serving at the altar on the other side of me. I couldn't lose, you know. And I don't remember too much more about things growing up. You know, I'm almost envious of those who do. You know, but to me, my childhood and I suppose adolescence and much later on, it seems sometimes I describe it as like still frames in the movie of life. It's just I remember glimmers. It's just like little flashes, moments. That's all I remember. After I finished high school, I went off to college and I went off to the major seminary and I became a Roman Catholic priest in 1971. That's why I ended up in the city of New Orleans. I do remember before I left Ireland that my mother exacted a promise from me, and that promise was, son, promise me that you will never drink and bring shame on this family. Mothers can be powerful. Especially with their sons, I think, or maybe it's because we left them, I don't know. But I remember that promise, and I got to the city of New Orleans, and the first assignment I had in this church community was on the edge of the French Quarter, in the Ninth Ward. It was heaven. Hell for the first 3 months, because each time I went out with my newfound friends in that community, and they go to the local watering holes in the Ninth Ward, and they're having their JD and Coke, and you know, rum and seven, and Jack's beer in those days, and Dixie and Falstaff. You know, all I was doing was having Coke. And in this mixed audience, I might need to clarify that. That's the liquid with the bubbles in it that's in a can. Okay. And all it did for me was made me burp a lot, you know. And I was looking at them, and they seemed to be kind of what we call today happy, joyous, and free. And I was missing the fun feeling of being a part of, because I felt apart from them while I was just with them. And I don't remember exactly when it was, but when I had my first glass of scotch, maybe after about 3 months of being in New Orleans, when I had my first glass of scotch, I found all my answers. And I think we can understand that, those of us who've been there. And I became someone who took off with it. Within 6 months, I was a noon drinker, and within a year, I was a morning drinker. Just within another year, it seems my behavior was coming to the attention of the powers that be, with those men in the tall, pointy hats. And they called me in to give an accounting of myself. And here was I, city born in Dublin, and here in the city of New Orleans, and no one mentioned alcoholism when they talked to me. But they told me that I was ending up in places that normally I might not expect to be. And that I was spending time with people that normally one might not associate with in my profession, at least publicly. You know, not the kind of people maybe we'd share moments with in church on Sunday mornings. And I'm telling you in a very general way, because that's what it says in our text, that we see in a general way what it used to be like and what happened. And if you've got a vivid imagination, that's your problem. You know, I would just keep it very general, you know, probably to protect the guilty. And they told me they were moving me, which was the solution to the problem in those days. You move the problem, you know. And I know today that if they could have found a place in Louisiana, further south or west for me from New Orleans, they'd have found it. But the place they found was a place called La Rose, Louisiana. And I lived there for the next 8 years, and what happened to me is those people loved me. They loved the unlovable. I went there with a horrible attitude. And the attitude was I was going to make life so miserable for those people. Don't you love it? Yeah. Because, you know, a member of the clergy or whatever, you know, supposed to be a quote-unquote inspiration, and I have this attitude I'm going to make life miserable for those with me. And the idea was that I would get back to New Orleans where I belonged, because in a small rural community it's very difficult to be anonymous. I think you can understand that. And I found out that what they didn't know about me they seemed to make up, you know. But it seemed I was gaining a lot of attention, because what I was doing at this stage, you know, within 2 years was, as I best recollected, drinking about a fifth a day. I was one of those drinking to live and living to drink, and days were becoming nights and mornings were becoming evenings, and everything just seemed jumbled, and I don't remember too much of anything. It's still a little scary to me today, my friends, that some people, thank you, some people come up to me today even, and back in Louisiana, and say to me, you know, you married our daughter and it was the happiest day of our life and it was wonderful, and I don't remember them, I don't remember their daughter, I don't remember the day. Celebrated hundreds of weddings and christenings and funerals and don't even remember being there. I was a blackout drinker. Just constant, constant, constant. And then when I became aware that somebody might become aware of my behavior, and of course at this stage I was loathing myself, you know, that self-loathing that we have. That feeling, I know today I identify it, we don't like the feelings of powerlessness as alcoholics, and that powerlessness and all those promises I would make, I'll never do it again. And all the stuff I tore down the commode and I said, I'll never do it again. And a half an hour later, be out the door looking for more. And that was me, all the time, all the time. And I literally hated myself, but I couldn't tell you that. My greatest fear was that if I told you who I really was, you might not like me. And so I had to act. And I was a wonderful actor on the outside. And inside I was dying. I was there from 1973, and the story continued, of which much I don't remember. I was told much afterwards, but much I don't remember. I do remember, though, and I was told afterwards, the date, October 11th, 1979, came around, and my boss then, Bishop Boudreau was his name, he was Cajun, very gentle person. He's since gone home to God, and I'm grateful to him. He was one of the few that hung in there with me. Of course, I think he enabled me to for a long time, but that was his decision. I suppose we do what we do the way we do it. But I remember getting a phone call from him and hearing his kind voice saying, Maliki, I'd like to talk to you like a brother. Come visit with me. That's all he said. I went over to his home that afternoon. He lived in Bayou Blue, or Blue Bayou, for those of you who like Crystal Gale. Bayou Blue. When I walked in the door of his home to visit with him, there were 11 other people there. And something told me that all was not well. It just didn't seem like a little social visit we were going to have. And I noticed they were all standing around the wall of his living room. None of them would come near me. And they told me afterwards it was because they were scared of me, because I was a vicious drunk. That's how I was. Not violent, but vicious. What I would do, and I was listening to Kathy at breakfast this morning, what I would do is I would find your weak spot and I'd go for you and shred you before you even got near me. That's how I defended myself. You know, and, so they stayed far away from me. And the good old bishop said to me, would you like something to drink? And something told me it would not have been good timing to have suggested what I really wanted. So I settled for some coffee. And he fixed it for me, he sat with me, looked me in my eye and said, Maliki, I love you, you drink too much. And I said, I do. For the first time, I admitted to another human being that I drank too much. No one mentioned alcoholism. I certainly didn't. And he said to me, will you accept help? And that word help, I didn't know what it meant, but it sounded good to me. And I know sometimes some of us have been there with these fleeting moments of clarity in the midst of the madness, as I call it, and help. And I said, here is this man caring about me, and I couldn't stand myself, but here he is caring for me. And he said, will you accept help? And I said, I will. And he said, good, here's your airline ticket. We alcoholics have amazing powers of recuperation. We do. Especially when we're threatened or feel threatened. And I thought this was moving a little bit too fast. I mean, I told him I would accept help, but he's saying, here's your airline ticket, and I'd no knowledge of what that meant. And of course, you know, my problem is, you know, that I'm selfish and self-centered and I have to be in control at all times and nobody can take that from me, or I feel out of control and I don't like it. So here's this man saying to me, I'm going somewhere that I hadn't decided on. They're going to send me up to a place in Rochester, Minnesota. And I started arguing with them. You know, us alcoholics are just a little bit belligerent. Almost reminds me still at Area Assembly these days. I describe this as a bunch of benign anarchists. You know, but it's that way. I think it's part of our illness that we're just argumentative. Or maybe, you know, we're just legends in our own mind, or are in love with the sound of our own voice, or combinations of all three, I don't know. But I started arguing with him and told him that it was a Thursday, as I vaguely recollect, and then I checked it afterwards it was. And I told him I had this couple to marry on Saturday, and I told him after I marry that couple, then I'll go off to this place you're talking about. And he said, I think they'll love you more if you go now. You know, I think we compromised and settled on the following day. It was an open ticket, and that evening I went back home and I had some alcohol in my drawer, and I thought that couldn't go to waste. And then I called some of my friends and I told them I was going off for a few days, and they said, well, come on up, we'll have a drink, you know, and went up the bayou, as we'd say, up the bayou. And I visited with them later on that night, and I vaguely remember in and out of the blackout, because that's how I was. I would just float in and out and have these little still frames, you know, to remember, and then I'm gone again. And I do remember, though, we were clinking glasses, and they were toasting my success in treatment. You know. I heard Tom last night, and thank you again, Tom, for that, you know, talking about the delusion. The delusion. How deluded I was. Yeah, I couldn't separate the truth from the false if it hit me. You know. I would lie because that was my familiar friend. I didn't trust anybody. I sure wasn't going to tell you anything about me. But they were toasting my success in treatment. And vaguely, I remember getting to the airport later on that day, and I flew to Chicago and had four doubles. And between Chicago and Rochester, didn't order any just to prove I didn't need it. And, you know, us with the dance, you know, I'm not that bad and I can control this. And I didn't realize it at the time, my friends, though, I was 260 pounds and dying on my feet. I didn't know that. I didn't. And I got to that place, and it was cold. I remember. First 10 days, I don't remember too much of anything, but I had this man assigned to me. His name was John from Los Angeles, and he's still sober by God's grace. He was assigned to me like a big brother, and he told me afterwards I was one of the most obnoxious, arrogant sons of guns that it had ever been his privilege to meet. And I thanked him. You know, I was like, felt right at home with that. You know, someone could finally acknowledge me. And he told me, I argued with him about length of stay there. That seemed to be important to me. And he told me I'd be there for quite a while. And I told him I'd only be there a few days. And he said, oh no, you know, this is a long program. And he told me, I told him that he was much older than I was, so he needed a lot more help than I did. And that was my attitude there. And I stayed there 3 months. I was the youngest person there. The person nearest in age to me was 26 years older than I was. Of course, I was very different. I remember going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous downtown Rochester, being shipped in the van from that place to the meetings. Felt we were being shipped like cattle. There were 8 others in the van. I would not speak to them. They were very troubled. that down in the house, place where they met in Rochester was, in fact, it was a gift to me. I was up in the Hiawatha land last year in Austin, and I had the opportunity to touch base with some good people who, for somehow, some strange reason, remember this very sick alcoholic back from those days. And I needed to hear what they had to say to me. Sometimes I jump around in my journey, but I suppose we speak the way God moves us to speak, but I do know that I'm one drink away, my friends. I can stand and look in a mirror and pause and start thinking and start swooning all in 5 seconds. I am an alcoholic. It's not that I was more of an alcoholic when I used to drink. This is a progressive illness. And Tom and others so well said it last night, and I keep saying in my own home group, that we have a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And we've absolutely no mental defense against taking that first drink. Our help must come. I love the words, must come from a higher power. Must. Those meetings, I wouldn't let you touch me, I wouldn't let you near me, I wouldn't hug you, I wouldn't shake your hand. And I know today was fear and self-loathing. I could sense the love that you had for each other, but I was afraid of that. I was afraid of it. Oh, I tell you, that loneliness of the alcoholic. But within 10 days I was getting well there, I want you to understand. You know, again, these amazing powers of recuperation. There was this old gentleman there at the meeting, and I always found someone to focus on at a meeting, because it was like I could pour out my venom inside on them. Not verbally, but I could just focus, eyeball them, you know. Almost like I eyeballed someone yesterday when they suggested that Ireland was still part of the British Isles, you know. That kind of eyeball, you know. Won't mention who. You know, but the colonial era has passed. Anyway. This guy chairing the meeting, old, wrinkled, baggy-eyed, and when he talked, he'd go, and he was definitely one of those. And he introduced himself as the chairperson of the meeting, and he said his name was Art. And within 10 seconds, I canonized him as Art the Fart. And that was my attitude at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I only tell you that to tell you how teachable I was. You know? I look back on it, he was sober and I was miserable. Yeah. And after 3 months of being there, I found out that you had to do a fourth and a fifth step of 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in order to be released from the loving embrace of that establishment where I was. And so I took the first step and took the second step and took the third step. But the only problem was it was kind of just real lip service. First step for me was I was willing to acknowledge I drank too much, and when I drank too much I got into trouble. But I wasn't powerless, thank you. My life had not become unmanageable because... So I would listen to you people at meetings and I'd hear your war stories and how you'd been to jail, you know. And listening to Tom last night there, but for the grace of God, myself many times. Because I was a blackout drinker and I drove. It was only God's grace, Tom, for me. We're no different. But you talk about being in jail and losing homes and families and jobs and children, and none of that stuff had happened to me. And of course I continued to believe I was different, and I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous just to continue to have you reinforce that I was different. It's a deadly disease, this. Deadly. It's a disease of perception, of attitude, of behavior, of thinking. It's not about booze anymore for me. It's but a symptom of the problem, as it says in the text. Alcohol is but a symptom of the problem. Selfishness, self-centeredness, self-will run riot. Goodness. And that was me. course, I couldn't see that at the time. When I left there in January of 1980 and returned to La Rose, Louisiana, those people continued to love me. Continued to love me. I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because it became part of the job description. I didn't go because I wanted to go, but I went to meetings. First year and a half, I didn't choose the sponsor because, after all, he was one of those. Yeah. And I got tired of you asking me, did I have a sponsor? So I relented and asked this person, Leonard Kay was his name, to be my sponsor. And I looked down my nose at him because, after all, I'd been in treatment, you know, and he shook himself in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we were different, you see, and I felt comfortable with that difference. So whatever he would say to me, I could analyze and dismiss, you see, because it was on the basis of his ignorance. Scary. And I stayed like that for the next 4 years, and I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you read how it worked, I believe that God had called me to tell you for the rest of the meeting how it really worked. And my sponsor, since, who's a member of that original group that has joined, quote-unquote, when I came back to South Louisiana in 1980, Joe R., or Cajun Joe, from Golden Meadow, he's my sponsor to this day. Joe would tell me that he said, Maliki, many of us grew in love and tolerance in those days. Because he said, I believe that God gives at least one like you to each group so that we can grow. That doesn't at all sound familiar. Okay. And after 4 years of going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I stopped going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to believe at the time that I'd carried the message long enough to you, and now it was up to you to do something with it. The reality was that I continued to loathe myself, and there was no freedom, and there was no happiness, and there was no nothing, and I wasn't following or working the principles. It was a game, and I got tired of the game. And I stopped going and became worse. Didn't drink. Late summer of 1984, I was over in Ireland visiting with my sister in Dublin. And for those of you who believe there's such a thing as non-alcoholic beer, can I disagree with you? See, less than 1% means more than 0%. I have a disease of thinking. She had a six-pack of O'Doul's in her refrigerator. And I visited with the O'Doul's, and all they did was make me go to the bathroom. I know I was looking for the effect. Didn't do anything for me except, you know, activate the plumbing, and that's about all it did. A couple of weeks later, sitting on the plane in London, getting ready to come back and to Atlanta and then on down to New Orleans, and the stewardess came up to me and said, will you have something to drink? And I said, I'll have a double beefeater and tonic without batting an eyelid. And I had a few of those, and thought went off in my mind, you people put me through hell. It was always you people. You told me that if I took the first drink, I would get drunk. And here I am after 3 or 4 doubles, and I'm feeling perfectly in control. And then I must have had another few, and another light went off in my brain, which is, you're not an alcoholic at all. And I came back to where I was living and pastoring at the time, and a few weeks later, I didn't pick up the drinking again. It was all part of me at the time. But I found myself out in the Broadwater Beach Motel in Biloxi, Mississippi, and soft lights and pretty waitresses and linen tablecloths and candles and partly after drink. I'm feeling perfectly in control. Ordered myself a double. Had a few doubles. Another light went off in my brain. Instead of paying hotel prices for mixed drinks, much cheaper by a fifth than mix your own. And then the real horror began. Because my friend alcohol turned on me. It didn't work for me anymore. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't stay sober, and I've heard that said. I could take one drink and go into a blackout. I could drink a fifth and sit here eyeballing you. It became totally unpredictable. before I used to, years ago, be able to predict that I could just go into a state of oblivion. I could predict that, or stay in a state of oblivion. Now it stopped working, and that was absolutely horrible. The few remaining friends I had started drifting away, except one, whom I mentioned by name. He's not one of us, but he's probably an incredible gift in my life. His name is Patrick O'Brien, from the old country. He hung in there with me, to the extent that for a few years prior to that, he would read daily the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he would go to meetings of Al-Anon just so he could cope with his own feelings. That was a gift to him and to me. He wanted to understand, quote-unquote, this illness, so that he could be there for me and with me and for himself. He came to me early November of 1985 and he said, "Maliki, you're killing yourself." Of course, in that year where I'd stopped and started and stopped and started, that year of late summer 84 to November of 85, after five stuff and stopping for 2 days and going on binges and disappearing and, oh yes, and going back to that place in Rochester frequently, and my boss sending me to a psychiatrist for 10 months once a week, and he was a wonderful gift in my life, and I'm glad they acknowledged that in our text. That we're supposed to make use of what those good people have to offer. He would ask me, "Are you going to your meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous?" The psychiatrist. "Are you drinking?" Of course, I'd lie with a straight face. Because as soon as I'd finished the session with him, and, you know, I'd BS'd and just continued to persuade myself, I was in awe of myself and how wonderful I was. I'd go off to the Bull's Corner in New Orleans and have a liquid lunch. You know, to celebrate surviving the psychiatrist one more time. You know, sick. He was a wonderful human being. And all of that stuff and people trying to love me and help me and then gradually pulling away and realizing, you know, he's got to do whatever he's got to do. And then early November came around and Pat came to visit with me and he said, "Maliki, you're killing yourself, you got to do something." And I knew it. I think I had a death wish at the time. Everybody had pulled away. My sister, that summer of 1985, when I went back over to visit, first day I was in her home, she comes in with her husband. She looks at me and she says, "Maliki, you're not welcome in our home anymore. We're going out for a while, and when we come back, we want you to be gone." She was the last one that was propping me up. And of course I gave her the half peace sign. You know, it's a peace sign. I gave her the half peace sign. Who needed her anyway? Oh, this is not a nice illness. We roar like a tornado through the lives of others. Yeah. And then that November of 85... with some prompting from Pat, I called my boss and I told him, "I'm leaving, I don't know where I'm going, I don't even know if I want to live." And I remember him saying to me, "Oh, Bishop Boudreaux, do what you need to do." He was tired too. He said, "Before you go," he said, "why don't you call this man that you mentioned to me?" This man's name is Hilary D. Father Hilary, as he's known to some. I'd met him at a gathering, something like this, back in 1983 when I was still dry. See, I'd come to large gatherings of Alcoholics Anonymous because I could lose myself in them. You know, didn't have to be involved with anybody. Just kind of float in, float out, you know, show up kind of thing. And he was the speaker and whatever he said touched me. I don't know to this day what he said, but whatever he said must have just cracked at my loneliness and emptiness. And I went up to him after the meeting like many did, and I found words coming out of my mouth that I had no intention of saying to him, and I said to him very simply, "Hilary, one of these days I'd like to come visit with you in Cullman, Alabama." He reached in his wallet, he took out his card, he put it in my hand, and he said, "When you are ready, come." That was all. "When you are ready, come." And he went on to the next person. I must have told my boss about Hilary, because Hilary is sometimes known as the drunk monk, and I was fascinated with a Benedictine abbot being in recovery, and he said he's a big man in his church. And those of you who know Hilary know that, you know, if you put him sideways, you would not mark him absent. You know, he is somewhat substantial. in presence. And I know. It's just, I can't say it's strange anymore. All I can tell you, my friends, is that God works. You know, there are no coincidences. They're just moments when God chooses to be anonymous. And I mentioned, you know, meeting Hillary to my boss, obviously, and he says, well, before you leave, why don't you call that man that you mentioned to me in Cullman, Alabama? And I retrieved his phone number. And thank God, when I called him, he answered the phone. And you have to remember, I met the man briefly once, 2 years before, a very passing moment. And I had not seen him since. And when he answered the phone, I said to him, Hillary, this is Maliki. And there was a pause. And across the silence of 2 years, all I heard him say to me was, are you ready? I said, of course I'm ready. He said, good, come. And he hung up. That was it. And those of you who have ever met Hillary or know Hillary, you know, he seldom invites. Most things come in the form of a directive or a command, you know. Incredible presence. I didn't even know where Cullman, Alabama was. I look on the map. I knew I had to get somewhere. I couldn't be where I was. I was pastoring two communities, and I was a tribunal judge and a chancery official and a whole bunch of titles, and dying of this illness. And they had a farewell for me in those two communities, I think for varying motives. Did it. And I slunk off. My plan was to drive to Cullman, Alabama, which is 454 miles due northeast of New Orleans. And I had to kind of find my way to New Orleans from where I was living. And on the way, what happened, my friends, is I took a drink and I went into a blackout. And I parked my car at the airport in New Orleans and I flew to New York and in the blackout. Flew to Ireland in the blackout and stayed with my mother 5 days in the blackout and crossed the English Channel and stayed overnight in Paris. And a week later, I came out of that blackout in a hotel room in Venice, Italy, which is a slight detour from Cullman, Alabama. And all I remember in that hotel room were the four hideous: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. But the terror, the not knowing, how did I get there? And still that death wish, and loathing myself, and nobody wanted me, and I didn't want me. And it felt like everybody had pulled away from me, and of course I'd pulled away from everybody, is what I'd done. Had nothing to do with them, really. And vaguely remember coming back across Europe, vaguely, and vaguely crossing this channel, and vaguely wanting to fall into the channel and end it, and saying those four words, God, please help me. And continuing to drink, and vaguely falling in the door, vaguely remembering falling in the door of friends of mine in Long Island, New York, Thanksgiving Day, 1985. They told me after staying 3 days there, and they thought I was going to die, and eventually I left them, just kind of the way we leave, you know. Getting to New Orleans, and then remembering strange that day, December 3rd, 1985, heading northeast from New Orleans, and I arrived in Cullman, Alabama, the evening of December 3rd, 1985, and it's been a day at a time since. Hillary took me in and talked to me the following morning. All he said simply was, I'll put a roof over your head, I'll put food on the table, and you will go to meetings. And it wasn't like asking me. And I'd nowhere else to go. I'd burned all my bridges. Nobody wanted me. I didn't even want me. I'd even, quote-unquote, come back to you, the very people I detested and loathed. And I was absolutely convinced that even what you had to offer couldn't work. I'd nowhere to go. And Hillary said, I'm going to assign another monk to work with you. And his name was Maliki. Maliki Shanahan, since gone home to God. Maliki was 14 years sober at the time and also had Parkinson's. And oftentimes I became his meeting when he couldn't get out the way he wanted to and go to meetings.
And I frequently go, I do not exaggerate, to 3 meetings a day because I had nowhere else to go. And part of the condition of living there was you would go to meetings. So go to meetings in Coleman. The downtown Coleman group became my home group. Going up those stairs and the naked blue bulb in the ceiling and the sofas with the springs coming up out of them and, you know, just wonderful people who loved me and I was scared to death. And they just kind of just brought me in the door. And they loved me when I didn't even want to love myself. People that just are gifts in my life today. Downtown Coleman group became my home group and I go to meetings in Boaz and Arab and Amiant and Decatur and Huntsville and was thrown into area assembly in Montgomery and I mean everywhere there was a meeting, I mean it was like you went to a meeting, you know, and that was it and no one questioned and those people continued to love me and what Malachy Shanahan did was it was his role to walk me through the steps in order, beginning with the first one. Mm-hmm. And after 3 months of intensive exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to feel my oats again. My Nigerian state meetings keep coming back, and I began to get a little bit resentful because I thought I didn't have to keep coming back as often as I had been coming back, you see. And I'd come back to Malachy Shanahan and I'd start complaining to him and I'd say, they keep saying it's going to get better. When is it going to get better? And he'd say, I've got 2 questions for you, Malachy. The first question is, did you take a drink today? And I'd say, no. And then he'd say, did you get in trouble today? And I'd say, no. Well, then he said, for an alcoholic, you are having a great day. And he would keep it that simple for me to get me over these humps where I was having what I would call intellectual orgasms, you know, and just being very, very absorbed in my own thinking, you know. And I lived there for 6 months and I came back to South Louisiana very scared because I thought there was going to be no AA like North Alabama AA. It was like it took hold of me. The gift that I received in North Alabama, my friends, was that I came to develop a relationship with the God of my understanding. See, I was raised with one particular kind of God, and that was a gift in my life for the time it was a gift in my life. But I do know that while I continued pastoring, there was a conflict within me between the God of my understanding I was developing in Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding the God I was asked to represent in the system. And it became a tremendous conflict for me. And this is not about anybody else's journey, because I've learned to have a profound respect for each person's religious views. They are our own affair, as it says in the text. And there are many, many ways, I believe, to walk with my God. And each person, the important thing is that we walk with our God. How we choose to do it is a matter of how we choose to do it. And whatever to me today supports me in walking with my God and developing a relationship with my God, that's all that matters. So I came back to South Louisiana with that turmoil beginning in me, very restless, you know, how am I going to find answers? And it was the tail end of May 1986, and I got a call from Enola. Her husband was Leonard Kay, my first window dressing sponsor, the one I'd asked to be my sponsor to keep you off my back. And she told me he was dying of cancer and would I come visit with him. And another one of God's grace moments for me. I hadn't been in touch with Leonard Kay for a number of years. After all, I mean, who needed him? In fact, he taught me something about being so non-judgmental about others in this program and how we choose to find and live sobriety. It was very close to, quote-unquote, my 5th dry birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous when I started drinking the O'Doul's and then started playing with the doubles. And, of course, I'd stopped going to meetings for a year. And my window dressing sponsor called me and told me, we missed you at your birthday supper. We have your 5-year chick for you. Did I tell him that I'd relapsed? I guess not. I was too ashamed. But he said, Malachy, he said, why don't you come visit Morgan City? That's where he lived at the time. And come to the store and I'll give you your chip. I went to that store. Walked in and it's a long room like this. He sat in the back on this high desk, and he said that's where he sat because he said he could get a clear shot at the front door in case a robber came in. He'd just tell everyone to duck, and he'd go boom, you know. I walked into the back to visit with him. I knew that he knew. He knew that I knew that he knew. He put that 5-year medallion in my hand. And he said, Maliki, I love you. Keep coming back. Didn't say we've missed your meetings for a year. I've had reports you're drinking again. Unconditional love. Unconditional love. So when Enola called me to come visit with him, I went to visit with him. It's the last day in May 1986, I sat with him. He was lying on a sofa in the living room and he said, Maliki, I'm soon going home to God. I want you to get a sponsor and this one work with him. I promised him. The following day, June 1st, he died. I buried him June 3rd. Came back to Houma, Louisiana, feeling very empty. Went to a 5:30 meeting that evening because I knew I had to be with you. And you understand that. I knew I needed to get a sponsor because I promised Leonard I would get a sponsor. People at the meeting, the chairperson said, anyone with a problem? I said, I think I might have one. I need a sponsor. I thought they were all going to jump up and volunteer. No one did. Those were just not too helpful. Yeah. After the meeting, gave me some phone numbers. I knew some of them vaguely, and of course, it's like, take the action if you want what we have. That was their way of doing things. That evening, on the way home from that meeting, Joe R.'s memory crossed my mind again, that used to tell me many of us grew in love and tolerance in those days. And I called Joe that night, hadn't talked to him in maybe 3 years, and all he said to me was, welcome home, Maliki, I've been waiting for your call. I asked him if he'd be my sponsor. He said, sure. And for the next years, Joe really walked closely with me, and that home group, the South Lafouche group, walked closely with me. And then I became active in the Bayou Black group in Houma. Stayed in close contact with Joe, but the conflict within kept getting larger and larger, and I talked to Joe about it, and he'd say very simply, trust God, clean house. Help others, the answers will come. Put one foot in front of the other. Oh, I used to go berserk in those days. I'd say, Joe, what does God want me to do? He'd say, I believe God wants you to walk the sidewalk sober today. I'd say, well, how am I supposed to walk the sidewalk sober? He said, it's very simple. He said, you put one foot in front of the other. And that's all he would say. I used to go berserk. In fact, I wanted him to tell me. But he wouldn't. He told me what I needed to do. Trust God, walk the sidewalk sober today. Put one foot in front of the other. Very simple. But time came, I suppose, where I had to do something because the conflict was tearing me up, it and others. I'll share a couple with them. Because sobriety to me is tremendously important and I have to be able to embrace my feelings today and where I am and thank God for your support. Back in 1988, I wrote an article, Everyone is Welcome at the Table. And of course, as a Catholic pastor, I was supposed to represent the people who were divorced and remarried, could not come to communion. And for years, I couldn't understand that kind of a God. You know, my God doesn't say to Mary, you're welcome, and to Christina, you're not. Yeah. My God loves me. He doesn't say, I will love you if. He doesn't say, I will forgive you if. He says, I forgive you. My God loves me bumps, once, lots, and warts and all. Does. And I've also come to believe that I do not need anybody's permission to walk with my God. I do not need anybody's permission to walk with my God. You've given me that freedom. But you know, when you pastor a particular church community and you preach publicly that everyone is welcome at the table, you know, within that gathering, you know, the local church would be very happy, the members of the church, but the powers that be, it seemed, became a little perturbed. because it seemed I wasn't following the party line, and I couldn't, I just couldn't. And also at that time, it's only because I was sober, I was able to join RAIN, which is the Regional AIDS Interfaith Network, and I became a caregiver. And worked with people who had AIDS, and they taught me the dignity of life, and the dignity of dying. One of them was a priest friend of mine, and I knew he'd been HIV for about 7 years. He'd gotten it through needle sticks and drinking and related behaviors, as many of us do. One day he called me and said, "Maliki, I was just told by the doctor I've developed pneumocystis. I need to go tell my boss, would you come visit with me?" And I won't mention where. What we did, we took off and we went to visit with his bishop and sat in his office, and my friend told his bishop that he'd developed AIDS, and the first words out of that man's mouth in fear was, "Well, you can't stay here, what do people think?" Which was very standard in those days. Similar delusions with that as we have in our own illness. I remember my friend looking at his bishop very kindly saying, "I wonder what Jesus would have said to the lepers and the prostitutes." And he left his office, and I buried my friend 2 years later. There were many events like that that maybe, when I talked to my sponsor about them, he said, "Maliki, you have to quit fighting, you know, because you're developing some horrendous resentments and they'll kill you." And so I made the decision to move on. It was what I had to do. Left something I loved. In the meantime, though, my sponsor told me to go back to school. He must have seen the writing on the wall. You know, sponsors are, they have interesting insights before they even happen to us for some strange reason. And he suggested I go back to school, and I went back to Tulane University in New Orleans and obtained my master's in social work. And in the interim, too, I was at a conference similar to this, and sharing something about my journey, this spiritual quest, as I would call it. And there was a lady there by the name of Lane from Tupelo, Mississippi. And I was at the Mid-South Young People's Conference on Alcoholics Anonymous in Shreveport, Louisiana, I think about 7 years ago now, yeah. And I spoke Sunday morning, and she came to me afterwards and shared some of her spiritual turmoil. She'd been raised in the Southern Baptist tradition, and it seemed that some of it was not meeting her needs where she was. She was an active serving member in Al-Anon. In fact, as we speak today, and I know we don't have anniversaries in Al-Anon, but she went to her first meeting of Al-Anon March 6th, 1982. And she's been active ever since. We talked, and then we'd meet at different conferences and we'd write, and it was a strange kind of friendship for me, you know, because most ladies in my life up to that time, it seemed, you know, I wanted to get very close to them. Tom, the imaginations are going wild here this morning. Basically, I had no idea what it was to have a relationship. I knew what it was to be in heat, you know, if you want to know what the answer is. So, with no idea how to connect to another human being, it had to be about being in control, which is what all that was about. And I'd often say to my sponsor, you know, in the latter years, I'd love to have a partner, and he'd say, "Well, Maliki, you've been having a series of these Roman candle relationships. You know what a Roman candle relationship is? You know what a Roman candle is?" Because he defined a Roman candle relationship as kind of a 4-day deal, although like it could be longer, but there's kind of like four pieces in it. First day you meet, second day you fall in sick, third day you fall in heat, fourth day, followed by terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, and asking, "How did that happen?" And, "Oh my God, the same again." And he'd say, "Well, if you keep doing what you've always done, you know, you keep getting what you've always got. If nothing changes, nothing changes." If you keep looking in the same places, you're going to find the same kind of people. So he said, maybe what my suggestion to you is, why don't you get out of the way and give God an opportunity to direct the traffic? And I did, very reluctantly. And it seemed over a couple of years that Lane's friendship and mine just kind of grew in its own way. It was kind of like a safe place for me, and we could just talk about what was important to us. And after I made the decision to move on, I pretty well finished graduate school again at this stage. I remember she's sending me a troll in the mail, orange hair, dressed in the priest's cassock and cross and collar, and saying, this is weird. You know, looking at this thing, and here am I moving on from it, and there's a horrible reminder out of my past, you know. And so I called her and wrote to her and asked her if it would be okay for me to come visit her in Tupelo, Mississippi. Because that to me was on the way to Cullman, Alabama. Slight way around, but you can go north, like to Jackson, you know, Mississippi, and got the trace to Tupelo, and then come across to Cullman. So I did visit it with her, and then visited the Abbey in Cullman, went to visit the grave of my friend Malachy Shanna, who had since gone home to God, and sat with Malachy for an hour, and I talked to him, and I think you can understand that, how we do. People may not be physically present to us, but the spiritual bond is always there, the part of my life. And I remember leaving that cemetery feeling it was okay. And later on that year, it was May, I was privileged to be at the Mountaintop Roundup in Lake Gunnersville, North Alabama. And Hillary was the voice, and Lane went with me, and my sponsor had already interviewed me and her sponsor, Kay, had interviewed her and me, and it seemed like everybody had interviewed us. But Hillary's blessing was important to me. And all that weekend in Lake Gunnersville, he said nothing. He spent a lot of time with Lane. Sunday morning spoke, and after the meeting he comes up to me, puts his arm around my shoulder. He said, I'm very happy for you and Lane. We married in August of 1993 up in New York, and the ceremony and reception was arranged by the very friends whose door had fallen in drunk Thanksgiving Day 1985. There was an irony in this. The preacher who married us was Episcopal and he was drunk. I felt right at home. Felt right at home. You know, it was interesting. Lane says, I think he's drunk. I said, it don't matter, honey. All we need is his signature. Shut up. Came back, and I was continuing to live in New Orleans. Lane lived in Tupelo. She's two sons from a prior marriage, and I told somebody about that weekend. Sean, who's 21, and Lyndon, who's 17. I inherited those as part of the package deal, and I decided that we were not going to have children. At this stage, Lane and I had moved to Lafayette, Louisiana. She made a conscious decision the boys needed to stay behind to get to know their absent father, with whom they haven't had a relationship for a long time. They needed to get to know him. And so we had an opportunity to get to know each other, moved to Lafayette. I didn't want to have children. I was adamantly opposed. I think it was because I was scared. Because my friends told me, Malachy, if you ever have a child, you know, you'll learn what it is to be unselfish in a hurry. You know, the thought for this alcoholic of being unselfish was just a little too threatening. You know, the truth were known. And I was working away and decided, no, we're not going to have kids. And Lane was not happy in Lafayette. It was a real testing time for her. She was away from her kids. She was away from her roots. She was away from everything, and she was with people who talked funny. Not only me, but she was with Cajuns. And I decided we were not going to have children, and within a few months she said she came around to accepting that, and then God took it out of her hands. September 23rd, 1994, our daughter Bridget was born. Her middle name is Aisling, which is the Gaelic for beautiful dream. At that stage, I suppose, too, there was a lot of pain in our lives, because when I made the decision to move on from the ministry, it created a lot of turmoil in our Irish family. it really tested my glib assertion that I respected everybody's beliefs, because now I was forced to accept my mother's beliefs. And my mother's belief was that I'd left the church, I'd married a Protestant, and she was divorced. Three strikes, you're out. And for the next 3 years, there was silence. She could not acknowledge my wife, she could not acknowledge our child, her first grandchild with us. She couldn't do it. Oh, at times I wanted to get even, because I knew the family skeleton, some of them. And I'm an alcoholic, and that I'd say to my sponsor, Joe, what am I supposed to do? He said, you will write to your mother. You will keep it in today. You will write to her. You will tell her what's going on with you. You will call her. It doesn't matter if she don't want to talk to you or to your wife. You will call her. And that went on for pretty well 3 years. My mother was in a deep depression is what it was. Her belief was, I turned my back on God. I turned my back on 800 years of history. I'd married the enemy, for God's sake. Well, think about it. Yeah. And left the church, and you see, my older brother's a Roman Catholic priest, and the army there is, you see, my mother must have believed that we were paying premiums on her heavenly insurance policy. You and I changed the equation, and, you know, God used to stand on her right hand and consult with her, you know. I mean, I'm serious, I know my mom. And I just upset that apple cart, and she had a tough time with it. And divorce was a big no-no in Ireland. Anyway, it's a whole tradition that I basically flew in the face of. But March 23rd, 1996, yeah. A triple bypass surgery. The day after, I don't remember this, I was in hospital. Lane tells me that the phone rang, and when she picked it up, she heard this voice saying, Lane, this is Bridie McCool, is there anything I can do for you? My mother broke the silence in 3 years. And it's been thawing and thawing and thawing, and I do believe it's God's grace on all sides. And in the meantime, in case I didn't get the message, you know, from God that he was in charge and in control, and I didn't want to have children, in February of 1996, which was a month before I had the open heart surgery, I was at a sunflower roundup in Kansas, and it was a very spiritual weekend, and that sense of spirituality continued. When I got home, and 9 months later, our son Colm Lachlan was born. And so here I am with two little ones, and God firmly in control, and teaching me messages, and I having feelings I never thought I could ever have or were possible. Incredible, you know. And our daughter Bridget, she's, you know, Ashling, beautiful dream. Sometimes she's just a lovable tyrant. You know, she's 3 and a half, and she looks at me and she says, you know, you go in timeout right now. Me! I get a little confused with all of that. And she says, no, pops the foot on the ground and walks down the hallway, and her ponytail just flops and the chin up. And I say to my wife, how in God's name did she ever get like that? And she looks at me and she says, you don't know. She's just like you. If God says the same May 26th of this year, Lane and Bridget and Colm and I are going over to Ireland to visit with my mom. It's been almost 7 years since I've seen her. She's ailing. She's in her 80th year. My sister tells me she's basically living for the moment, and then she believes she'll slip home to God. I have you. You've been my family for so long. And it's only because God's grace working through you that I can be with you. And that I can feel these feelings and allow people to love me. And go visit with my mom and make amends to her. Because for years I wanted to believe that she was wrong. And now I can go and ask her forgiveness. Amends happen in different ways. You remember I mentioned way back, and I'll try to wrap this up because Jay said he was throwing me out at 11. Remember I used that couple as an argument with my bishop not to go to treatment straight away. I was going to marry them on the Saturday and, you know, then whatever. I often wondered what happened to them. Did I? Well, I didn't show up. I mean, I was off on the plane to Rochester. And I sometimes wondered, you know, in the process of, you know, making a list of all persons we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all, I mean, they were on the list. I know where they were. That was 1979. 1993, my sponsor Joe asked me to come back to my original home group. He said, we want to check you out. You know what I mean. Asked me to come speak at the speaker night meeting. At this stage now, I wasn't 260 pounds anymore. I had a beard and I'm a little bit slimmer than that. And when I opened my mouth, I saw these two women and the meeting kind of move and look funny and paid no more mind to it. And after the meeting, both of them come up to me and one of them looks at me and says, do you remember me? I hate that question. I feel incredibly vulnerable when any lady under the age of 85 approaches me and says, do you remember me? Because I was a blackout drinker. I said, do you remember me? And I'm vaguely trying to pull something out of the fog of the past and it wouldn't come to me. And she says, my name is Suzette and you're supposed to marry me and my husband 13 and a half years ago. And you never showed up and I wanted you to know our day was ruined and went up in smoke and I've hated you ever since. But I also want you to know that I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 2 weeks ago, picked up a desire chip, and I want you to know that I understand. And we cried and I made amends to her, and then it dawned on me about her mother and father, and I said to her, oh, how's your mom and dad doing? Maybe I need to call your dad. And she says, ooh, I don't think I'd do that if I were you. He's still looking for you. But she said, we'll keep a chair for him here. And one of these days, maybe he'll come in the door like you and I. And maybe one final little thought. There's so much I could tell you about sobriety. God, it's just, it continues to unfold for me. You know, it's not like, you know, all of a sudden I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you know, everything's wonderful. It's like, now my life is unfolding and, you know, all I know is that God is good. But my daughter is my teacher in many ways. You know, but in another way, a few months ago, I mean, she lived in Louisiana with us. Obviously, we came back to Tupelo last year, and that's a story in itself. I got a job in Tupelo at this particular area clinic, and 10 days before the closing on our home, I was fired, and really, you talk about some interesting times. What that forced me to do is go out on my own, which I've done since and haven't looked back. You know, and opened up my own office. I'm very grateful to God for that. I saw it as an opportunity. My wife said, is God doing for you what you were not willing to do for yourself? He pushed you out the door. I loved the work I was doing, but I don't know if I particularly needed to be where I was. Anyway, and a lot of the work I do today are with children who've been sexually assaulted with their families, and I work with adoptive parents, and I work with couples because I love a good fight. But I love working with family systems, and I work with our local good old parole people town and youth court and legends, you know what I'm talking about. And the strange thing is that most of them who come visit with me for some strange reason have either been bending the elbow or squeezing the grape injudiciously. As I would say, strange. Maybe that's why I'm in Tupelo. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, Bridget, my daughter, is my teacher. A few months ago, I come home from work. Sometimes I'm exhausted, but I know my life continues. And There's no point in explaining to a 3.5-year-old that daddy's tired. She don't understand that. She'd been missing her daddy all day. Since her daddy's wrapped around both of her little fingers and a few toes as well, I mean, there is no argument. I'm lost. I'm done for. Yeah, I am. I'm sober, and I suppose I'm jumping here, but I think the greatest gift I give our two children today is that they have a sober daddy. Mm-hmm. And that's all because of you. You know, that is the greatest gift I give them, that I'm sober by God's grace. Or Bridget won't even playing with Play-Doh. I said, Daddy, come play Play-Doh with me. I said, okay. She said, make me an alligator. So make an alligator, the Louisiana days, and make me a turtle. That's a turtle. And she said, make me a swamp. Well, that was a challenge. Swamp was kind of large, so I did a kind of a flat thing with a few cypress knees sticking up out of it. And then all of a sudden she says, make me an ice cream cone. And I looked at her ice cream cone, like that's not nothing to do with a swamp or cypress knees or alligators or turtles or any of that stuff. And she looks at me with her blue eyes and she says, you can do it, Daddy, you can do it. And the thought that came to me much later that night before I fell asleep was that that's the relationship that my Heavenly Father asks me to have with Him today. Malachi, I can do it, I can do it, Malachi. And he does. And I want to thank you so much for loving me today. I love you.